Ron, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. I'm Ron, and I'm joined as usual by Dave. Today we are giving you portions of an interview we conducted with two guests we'd been looking forward to sitting down with for some time. Boyd and Chris are researchers into the history and culture of what they term mutual aid societies, which include 12-step fellowships such as NA. Dave and I also share a passion for NA history. Chris and Boyd have done extensive work examining that history, including spending hours or days in New York at the AA General Service Office, searching the archives for any correspondence that Bill Wilson, AA's co-founder, conducted during the 1940s and 1950s. They also scoured the web for any available documentary record of NA's earliest beginnings, and conducted interviews with family or friends of some of the people directly involved. So we sat down with them via video teleconference for the first in a series of free-ranging discussions of NA history. The focus of this episode is on the birth of NA and the context of the times before, during, and just after that birth. It turns out, even that period of our history presents challenges in the telling. There are various versions and various viewpoints on what is rightly considered to be the history of the NA Fellowship that is now flourishing around the world. The question is, what, among all the various efforts and groups springing up beginning in the mid-1940s, constitute the roots of our fellowship? You'll hear us grapple with that question in some detail. All four of us have been studying this for a while and get deep into the weeds very quickly. So I'm going to start out this episode by introducing a few of the people and places you'll hear us speaking about. When we talk about Lexington, we're talking about a federal institution, sort of a combination correctional facility and hospital, created in May of 1935 in Lexington, Kentucky, in an effort to address the then-growing problem of narcotics addiction. It is by pure coincidence that this is exactly the same month and year that AA was founded in Akron, Ohio. That was the month that Bill W., a stockbroker from New York on a business trip to Akron, met Dr. Bob, a local physician, and Bill carried the message of hope to Dr. Bob, who was suffering hopelessly from alcoholism. These two very different entities, AA and the Federal Narcotics Farm in Lexington, as it was sometimes called, progressed each in their own direction for about a decade before they would meet each other in a way that would spawn what became Narcotics Anonymous. And that brings me to a second name I want to introduce you to, Houston S. When you hear us speak of Houston, we're talking about a very early AA member who moved to Lexington for his job in the mid-40s. At that time, there was a growing chorus of discussion within AA about how to deal with drug addicts coming to meetings. The Grapevine began to publish articles on the topic, and there was a lot of correspondence in the AA archives between the General Service Office of AA, usually Bill Wilson, and various people seeking guidance on how to best deal with this. You'll hear more on that in the interview. Houston, realizing he now lived in the city with this huge federal narcotics farm, decided to see if he could bring the AA model of recovery to narcotics addicts. As part of this volunteer institutional work, he started a 12-step fellowship there he called Addicts Anonymous. So that's the third name, Addicts Anonymous, Houston's group modeled after AA, located in the Lexington Hospital. A fourth name I'll briefly introduce is Danny Carlson. Danny was a narcotics addict who landed in Lexington very soon after its founding and was hospitalized there several times over the next decade as he sought treatment, only to relapse again upon each release. His final stay there ended in 1949, having been introduced to recovery by Houston and the Addicts Anonymous Fellowship there. Danny left the hospital and returned to New York in 1949 with the intent of starting an Addicts Anonymous group in New York. Sometime in 1949 or 50, he did just that, except he decided to call it Narcotics Anonymous to avoid confusion with the acronym AA. Most NA members hearing this will know that the founding of NA is today commonly considered to be 1953 in the Los Angeles area, 3 years after Danny gave the name Narcotics Anonymous to his group in New York. This effort was started by a group of AA members, including Jimmy Kinnan, who is commonly thought of as the founder of NA. So that's where this gets interesting, and you will hear us discuss it quite vigorously in the interview to follow, with differing opinions offered by each of us. Was Danny's effort something else, even though it was called NA? Both East Coast and West Coast NA had ties back to Lexington, as you'll hear. What significance does this have? So you'll get more detail on all of this in the interview to follow, but I wanted to give you a primer first to avoid confusion when you begin hearing these names. Lexington, the federal narcotics hospital founded in the mid-1930s in Kentucky. Houston, the AA member who began trying to bring the AA model of recovery to addicts in Lexington in the mid-1940s. Addicts Anonymous, the name Houston gave to this effort. Danny, the protege of Houston, who went back to New York in 1949 and carried this work forward under the name Narcotics Anonymous, and Jimmy, the AA member in Los Angeles, who, with a group of other members, started in 1953 what became NA on the West Coast. Now, having given you that much background, we'll hit the ground running with this interview. I'll break in here and there when I think a little more clarification might be helpful. The first speaker you'll hear is Dave, with a question addressed by Chris.
When did you become aware, and through what medium, that there was a fellowship on the East Coast in the late 40s? Was it through your review of the book, My Years with Narcotics Anonymous by Bob Stone?
Ron and Dave, thanks so much. This is a really exciting thing that you guys are undertaking, and real privileged to be a part of the conversation.
To help you understand Chris's answer, here are a couple of facts. Bob Stone was a non-addict who served as the general manager of the NA World Service Office soon after the basic text was first published. Bob worked for the WSO for about 9 years, and after he left, he wrote a book, part memoir and part history book, entitled My Years with Narcotics Anonymous. Miracles Happen is a coffee table book published by NA World Services, which presents pictures and a narrative of the history we're discussing here. Slaying the Dragon is the title of a book written by William White, a noted researcher and chronicler of the history of addiction and recovery. Boyd and Chris had collaborated with Bill White in writing a chapter on NA when he updated his book a few years ago. Chris goes on to answer Dave's question.
For me, it was the Miracles Happen book in 98, and then reading the first edition of Slaying the Dragon, and then learning more about it from the Bob Stone book. And then since that time, learning about a lot of folks who've already done some kind of research into this history, you know, including yourself, Dave, that predates kind of internet access. So I feel like we've been able to stand on the shoulders of people who've done a lot of work before us.
So pretty early on, the name Houston emerged in your inquiry.
Well, first of all, thanks for having us. This is it's pretty exciting for both of us. But, Chris had known about Houston even before I came aboard, I'm thinking.
I can speak to that. I mean, I was aware of Houston, was aware of Addicts Anonymous, and I work at a place in Raleigh, North Carolina, called the Healing Place, Wake County. And our medical director is a guy named Dr. Al Mooney. And I knew that his father was in recovery, had been in recovery, had passed. And but I didn't know a lot of his story. I knew that his father and his mother had opened a treatment center in Statesboro, Georgia, called Willing Way Hospital. And so as I was really exploring AA history at the time, I tracked down a talk that his father gave. I found the CD online and purchased it. It was a talk from 1967 in Lake Worth, Florida. And I sit here and I listen to this talk and I go, I can't believe it. Everything that I've been researching, Al Mooney's dad has been a part of. He'd been at Lexington. He'd been an editor for the newsletter, The Key, that was the publication of the Addicts Anonymous group. His sponsor was Houston S. And I turned to Al. I said, Al, how is this that we've been working together for a few years here? And I had no clue that your dad was so intimately tied into these things that were of interest to me. And that was probably around 2003, 2004 or so.
Well, I had come across the book, recovery book, written by Dr. Al Mooney, and I was floored because I had already been researching Houston and the New York Fellowship. And through that, I became friendly with Dr. Mooney's widow, Dot Mooney. And she had a wonderful memory about those times and the early meetings. And he had a remarkable contribution to Addicts Anonymous.
Okay, well, let's back up just a step and tell us about the significance of the Lexington Hospital first.
Okay, well, you know, you back it up even further, Ron, and, you know, AA started in May of 35, and I think from the very beginning there, or within a few years, people were starting to wonder, it's like, okay, will this formula work for people that are addicted to substances besides alcohol?
Here, Boyd describes the Harrison Act of 1914, the significance of which is that it criminalized addiction and thus had a significant effect on society's approach to it.
Because of the Harrison Act in 1914, the federal prisons just started getting a very new prisoner in there, and it was people addicted to substances, well, basically to opiates is what it was. And the wardens were having a very difficult time in knowing what to do with those folks. And so by my readings, there was a few wardens that actually petitioned Congress, but Congress obviously thought that it was a very good idea. So in 1929, they established a law establishing two narcotics farms. And the first one opened in 1935, and that was in Lexington, Kentucky.
Okay, so Houston begins to work with a guy in Lexington named Danny Carlson. Tell us about that.
Danny actually went to Lexington in the very first year that Lexington opened. And after his seventh admission in 48, he actually starts attending the Addicts Anonymous meetings there. And then he obviously goes, he is released from Lexington, and he's back in 1949, and he pretty much falls under the mentorship of Houston because he writes about it. He says, Houston taught me to hope at last. Hmm. And so Danny gets out sometime in 49, and then sometime in late 49 starts the first meeting. He starts the very first meeting in the Women's Detention Center in New York City on Sunday night. And then we think somewhere in the early 1950 starts the very first non-institutionalized meeting that's open for the public at the Y. And he was a man that was very much, trying to do the right thing, and was, it seems as though, very driven. There's an article. It's called A Short Story of Narcotics Anonymous. It was written by Patrick Sherwin, I believe, in 1965. And in that article, he talks about that when Danny got out, he was used to Addicts Anonymous, and he wanted to do something a little bit different because he didn't want the AA to be confused with Alcoholics Anonymous. So he chose Narcotics Anonymous. And so that's where the name Narcotics Anonymous comes from our research. Now, what's really interesting about that is that the man who wrote it worked right beside Ray Lopez. And after Danny C. died, Ray Lopez took over Narcotics Anonymous in New York.
So would it be fair to say that the term Narcotics Anonymous was being used around 1950?
We feel pretty confident that it was being used in 1949.
So you've got Danny in 1949, 1950 in New York, and we know Bill W's there, and he's running the show at AA. Is there any indication anywhere through your search of the archives or any articles that there was ever any contact between Danny C. and Bill W.?
We haven't seen anything directly connecting them. We've seen communication between the Addicts Anonymous group as early as the late 40s, asking if they would publish an article in the Grapevine about him. We see correspondence between a woman named Betty T, who leaves Lexington in 1950 and in 1951 forms the Habit-Forming Drugs Group of Alcoholics Anonymous.
This group, HFD, as it was known, was in Los Angeles.
And she formed it because she saw members of AA who were struggling with barbiturates and narcotics. And she saw people who were straight addicts, quote unquote, who were having trouble finding recovery in AA. She ended up corresponding with Bill Wilson a tremendous amount. We came across these letters in the General Service Office archives. And there's a lot of correspondence between 1951 and 1957. The early correspondence, Betty talks about corresponding with Danny C. and saying, I can't go along with what Danny C. is doing with NA in New York. So she's at least writing to Bill about Danny C. So you got to think that Bill has an awareness of what Danny C. is doing in New York. But we haven't come across any direct linkage between AA, Bill Wilson, and Danny C.
What did she say her objection was to Danny?
Yeah, it was interesting. She says, I got my recovery in AA. I owe my recovery to AA. And I wouldn't or couldn't think of doing anything to go against AA. And which was an interesting thing, because in reality, what she was doing was she was going against AA by creating a dual purpose group. What's also interesting, though, is that AA during this time of the late 40s, early 50s is struggling with the fact that alcoholics don't seem to be mindful or aware of the problems of other substances. So in 1948, there's an AA publication called Sedatives and the Alcoholic, which is really kind of a collection of Grapevine articles that's reprinted into one brochure. And then in 1952, they do another version of it. And interestingly, in that publication, they say that in some cases, it may be appropriate for AA groups to have special meetings for persons who had dual problems with alcohol and other drug addiction. So you actually had AA at that time kind of saying, maybe we need to have a special group for addicts. But really everything that she was doing by bringing addicts into AA, having this meeting, was kind of really going against AA. And this really came to a head in 57 when Bill's beginning to get a lot of pressure, particularly out of Southern California, about, you know, all these addicts that are coming to meetings. And the funny story is Boyd and I, on our first trip to New York to the General Service Office, they're very hospitable up there. And they have a very interesting process where you come in, you can't make copies of any correspondence. You either have to dictate it, type it yourself, or, you know, hand write it out. And so we're dictating these letters into a recorder, and all of a sudden we hit these correspondence between Bill and Betty, where all of a sudden they went from love and flowers and happiness to daggers, you know, and we're like, oh my God, what's going on? And I remember being in there and we're racing trying to get through these as they're shutting the lights off on a Friday evening, trying to get out of there. It required us to go back for subsequent trips, but it really is what happened is Bill finally says, listen, all these addicts come into AA meetings is creating problems, and I'm going to address this, and I'm going to address this in the Grapevine. And so in February of 58, Bill writes this, you know, pretty important Grapevine article called Problems Other Than Alcohol, What Should Be Done About Them. And in it, he basically concludes that there's no room in AA, that no non-alcoholic can ever become an AA member.
Well, that seemed to be his only restriction. Would you agree that as long as you were an alcoholic, if you had some other problem, you were certainly welcome to AA meetings?
Yes, that's exactly it.
This article was made into a pamphlet that can still be found on the literature tables at AA meetings today. In it, Bill calls addicts, quote, first cousins of a sort, unquote. But if we are not also alcoholics, then we cannot become AA members. Here's a snippet. Quote, our first duty as a society is to ensure our own survival. Therefore, we have to avoid distractions and multipurpose activity. An AA group as such cannot take on all the personal problems of its members, let alone the problems of the whole world. Sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. Groups have repeatedly tried other activities, and they have always failed. It has also been learned that there is no possible way to make non-alcoholics into AA members. We have to confine our membership to alcoholics, and we have to confine our AA groups to a single purpose. If we don't stick to these principles, we shall almost surely collapse. And if we collapse, we cannot help anyone. Unquote. This clear definition of the word written here, quote, sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, unquote, is in large part what's behind NA's difficulty with the word in describing our principle of total abstinence from all drugs.
Now, just backing up a little bit on the name Narcotics Anonymous, I've read in another source that narcotics at that time referred to heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. And it was basically a criminal justice term used by police departments. Do you have any indication that Danny C. in any way tried to restrict who was able to claim membership in NA by virtue of whatever drug they used?
Never come across anything like that?
Yeah, not at all, Dave.
One observation that I've made looking at this timeline that we're talking about right now is that the traditions were being developed in the mid-40s, late-40s, but were actually adopted by the General Service Conference in 1950, correct?
Yeah, it was adopted. They didn't quite have a General Service Conference yet. It was adopted at the first International Convention of AA in Cleveland in July of 1950.
Okay. And so Danny's efforts to begin a fellowship were happening right about at the same time, maybe just a little bit earlier, right?
Correct.
And it appears, based on the way that Danny handled Narcotics Anonymous that started in New York, that they never adopted the traditions. Is that true?
I would say very true. We've never found any evidence that they did.
It always struck me that there's no indication, really, that Danny ever attended AA, appeared not to have ever quoted any AA literature, that he really seemed to have come directly out of Addicts Anonymous and sort of created his own thing using the 12 steps, but everything else seemed kind of his own creation. Would you agree with that?
I would, but I also tend to think, Dave, that even in 48, they were having, the Grapevine was having publications of the traditions. And so I tend to think that at least there was some talk about it. That's what I speculate anyway. But it could have been like a very small blip on the radar screen for Danny. I mean, you're quite right. He may not have even known that they existed.
Well, I have read articles as early as 51 where he did not use his last name in the article. And other articles, he very openly used his last name. So there was, I gather, some familiarity with the notion of anonymity.
Well, yeah, and you've got the newspaper article that talks about he'll hold a meeting, but that most of the members will wear masks. So yeah, there's definitely that. And there's a picture from some magazine with Danny in it where he's holding his head down and putting his hand over it. Whereas there's another guy with a big cigar that's just, you know,
That's a Saturday Evening Post article. I always wondered if that was his attempt to hide his face.
I don't know. You know, Chris makes a joke about it in our presentations about, you know, that when we started this thing, Danny was all smiles and happy and looking up, but he's done it so many times that now he's just kind of like, oh my goodness, can we get this over with?
But he clearly was a bit of a promoter, was he not? And the word went out nationally in various publications that there was a group, Narcotics Anonymous, in New York City.
And see, that's actually the, in my opinion, and well, in Chris's and my opinion too, is that really and truly, that's his, that is his uncredited contribution to our movement. is that what Danny, because he actually, you know, see, this is where anonymity is a double-edged sword. Because Danny broke his anonymity and national newspaper or national magazines and also newspapers put articles out, it actually put in the consciousness of America hope, because they now knew that there was something like AA for people addicted to, you know, opiates. And so, you know, mom and pop wondering what to do with their kid actually could say, wow, this is awesome. You know, there is some actual hope here that's happening. And that is a really, in my opinion, his uncredited contribution to our movement.
Well, the same thing was going on in AA too. There were times that Bill was open and had anonymity breaks, and certainly Marty Mann, there's an article in that she was on radio and there were articles in the grapevine where she used her first and last name, and that was done with Bill's blessing. So in their infancy, there were times at which anonymity was not preserved as well.
My understanding is that, and I could be wrong, Chris might correct me on this, as he certainly has my permission to do anytime that I misquote something, is, you know, in watching the Bill W. movie, I found out that the Saturday Evening Post, they actually had pictures of Dr. Bob and Bill in that, and that was the Saturday Evening Post said that, it's my understanding that they said, well, you've either got to have a picture or there's no article at all. And so he said, okay. You know, but it is my understanding that from that point forward, they didn't do anything, because we've certainly got pictures of where they're, you know, you see the back of their heads and stuff like that in a gathering or so forth, so on.
Well, Bill always described the development of the traditions as, he always said that they were hammered out on the anvils of bitter experience, and that those anvils of bitter experience were throughout those early years. They did all kinds of anonymity breaks and flirted with affiliation and taking on things other than what they do. And it's the traditions, in a sense, are a record of that, of those efforts and little guideposts where they're saying, we don't want to step here. We've already stepped there, you know. And I guess there was some famous baseball player or something that then went out and drank after his, after he was famously a member of AA. So I'm sure we could come up with any number of circumstances, like the Jack Alexander article was 1941. The traditions were 1950s. So, these are the anvils.
Just a word about the Jack Alexander article we keep mentioning. This was an article published in 1941 in the Saturday Evening Post, which is credited for bringing AA into the national consciousness of America for the first time. This was before television, and this magazine is said to have been on virtually every coffee table in the country. The Big Book was published in 1939, and, as Bill often put it, languished in a big warehouse while they tried to figure out how to let people know about it. After the Jack Alexander article, the AA office in New York was inundated with requests for information and orders for the book. This precipitated an extended period of explosive growth for AA.
You know, before we move on too much from the origins, you know, it occurred to me in looking at the history of NA, we really are a prison fellowship. We arose out of a prison, Lexington, Kentucky. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, to kind of back up to what Boyd brought up before, I mean, the 1914 Harrison Anti-Narcotic Act, kind of where we see all of a sudden the criminalization of addicts. It was that act that started putting addicted individuals in prisons that led to the narcotic farms, the formation of the narcotic farms.
Well, that's an interesting observation, though, Dave. I've never really looked at it that way before.
Well, you look also what happened on the West Coast. I know there are several variations we're going to get to, but mm-hmm. one of them is that it was a sheriff's kind of urging to get this NA movement, get something going for addicts within the prison. So it keeps me humble to remember that if you look at the origin of Addicts Anonymous, it's really in a prison.
That is very interesting. And I don't know that you could call that a version either in the Los Angeles story, because the letters are so clear between Jack P. and Bill W. in 1952. Why don't we go to that? Why don't we switch coasts now and say, and it, I think it's fair to say that we have a distinct and different movement going on the West Coast. Or would you guys dispute that? Would you say that, I mean, they have a common origin, the thing that eventually became Narcotics Anonymous on the West Coast with Jimmy Kay and all of that sort of calls that its founding. Is that distinct from the Danny Carlson movement is what I'm getting at? Are those completely separate things with a common origin of the Lexington Hospital? Is that how you would see that?
I see them as being different branches from Addicts Anonymous in some ways, but also different branches out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, for the West Coast, the influence of Alcoholics Anonymous was much more clear and deliberate than it was for Danny. But you see the influence of Addicts Anonymous both in them referencing the Our Purpose bylaws, which the Our Purpose was a beautifully written piece that appeared in the letter, The Key, the publication by the Addicts Anonymous group. And we even came across a letter recently written to Jimmy Kay by his son. And the letter's dated December of 1953, after the first NA meeting's been held on October 5th, kind of officially held as We Are Narcotics Anonymous and We Are Open for Business. And this letter of December of 53, his son says to Jimmy, how's your Addicts Anonymous group coming along? And that's the first time that we've seen in the same sentence, you know, Jimmy Kay and Addicts Anonymous. It's all been kind of peripheral up until that point. So I would say Addicts Anonymous, you know, influenced Narcotics Anonymous in many ways on the West Coast, but it also grew out of Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that Danny C's NA did not. And when Jimmy came in to AA in January of 50, he basically had a couple of years there of heavy involvement with Alcoholics Anonymous, of heavy involvement with the emerging emphasis on the traditions and so forth. And I think that that played a different role in influencing the development of Narcotics Anonymous than it did on the East Coast. You also, you know, Danny comes out of Lexington as a solo man, runs out there and says, I'm going to get this thing going. And Jimmy, along with five other members of Alcoholics Anonymous who had dual problems, started holding the first organizational meetings. So there were kind of a group of people as opposed to a sole individual. And the other thing I'll just say real quickly is that, you know, what Jimmy and the early members did was very different from what Danny C. did. Both versions were facing intense pressure and kind of oppressive practices by law enforcement. You know, Danny C.'s having people from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics come into meetings and arresting addicts. Jimmy's facing the same thing. They're under surveillance on the West Coast, but they did something very different than what Danny did. Instead of aligning themselves with non-addicts to try to get some credibility and some space, and Jimmy talks about it in the 20th anniversary talk, says, you know, we went down there and just dealt with the police directly and told them that they need to give us space so that we can meet.
All right, well, there's a guy fits into the picture about here, Jack P., AA member from Los Angeles, who you guys dug up some correspondence between him and Bill Wilson in 1952. And those letters seem to indicate that he was in contact with the sheriff, the LA County Sheriff, who was looking for something like an AA group, which seems to be the pattern in a lot of places. People are looking for something like AA that can be used to help addicts. So this is going on in the LA County Jail, and Jack has been doing AA work in the LA County Jail. So the county jail folks ask him if he can do something for addicts, and he reaches out to Bill Wilson. I was just going to ask you to take it up from there, and what do you see as the significance of the role he played?
Yeah, so Jack was a very interesting individual, and he was doing institution work with a woman named Helen W., I believe, whose story in the big book is Freedom from Bondage. And there was not, again, a real kind of infrastructure at that time for hospital and institution work. And, you know, there were some members who kind of balked at the idea of carrying the message into a jail and so forth. But he got very involved in doing this. And one of the letters that we came across in the AA General Service Office was written by Jack to Bill on July 27th, 1952. And he basically says that the authorities of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department have asked him to initiate a Narcotics Anonymous group in the women's division of the county jail because of the success that they've been seeing with the weekly AA meetings that are being held there. And so, you know, I think that one of the things that this speaks to in general is just kind of when there's an innovation in one area, where individuals or groups or organizations with a similar type of issue will start looking towards that innovation to see, hey, could this possibly work for us, whether that's in medicine or in business or what have you. And in this case, it's like, wow, this thing is working for alcoholics. Could this work for addicts, you know? And that's kind of what prompted the sheriff's department to ask Jack about initiating this. And so Jack writes to Bill, and Bill writes back to congratulations upon the narcotics project. This is a subject which interests me immensely. And then he goes on to say, probably the best source of information is the narcotics hospital in Lexington, which I'm glad to see you plan to contact. Some members of the local AA have formed, some of them former narcotics, I believe, have been working inside the Lexington institution with slow but tangible results. So basically what Bill is doing is directing ACP back to Lexington and the Addicts Anonymous group. And we know that Jack P ends up working closely with Jimmy. So it's just, again, kind of another link to the influence of Addicts Anonymous.
Okay. Well, the thing that I really find most interesting in that letter is the way Bill characterizes the relationship between addicts and alcoholics, that he very persistently in so much communication at that time was really emphasizing that alcoholics and addicts simply don't mix well. They don't like each other. Can you read what he said, kind of what he says about that?
Oh yeah. It's rich. He says, however, that doesn't mean that you people in LA can't jump the gap. I certainly think you ought to try, though I agree it should not be in the least under AA auspices. For some reason hard to fathom, alcoholics do not care for narcotics, and narcotics as a class disdain us. They think we're gutter snipes. Another difficulty you will have is this. Apparently morphine and its derivatives does such terrific things to the honesty department that it is hard to get a sound moral area into which the AA program can be introduced. Dope has made these otherwise fine people so phony that it's hard to make a beginning. So it's just very interesting, you know, kind of the perception and attitude that Bill communicates about persons who are addicted to drugs other than alcohol.
Yes, and just before that, you know, you the part that you read, he talks about jumping the gap. He's using a metaphor there that's where he talks about the transmission of, it's almost like the alcoholic is almost like a conductor of some sort of electricity or the conductor of this message of hope. And if you have an alcoholic and an alcoholic, you have essentially a circuit in which this can flow and be connected. But if you have an alcoholic and something else that you can't, that there's a gap there that he says in his experience, unless the person is an alcoholic also, can't really be bridged. So when he says jump the gap, and I'm almost getting a picture of an electrical circuit and the little electricity jumping across the gap.
And he says, and right before that, he says, their experience indicates that the narcotic, and when he says their experience, he's referring to Addicts Anonymous, that the narcotic who is formerly an alcoholic can transmit straight to the narcotic himself. to a narcotic, that is, who was never an alcoholic. So there is this whole kind of conversation, and we hear later on in the West Coast reference to bridge members. So jumping the gap, bridge members, people who are able to kind of transmit the Alcoholics Anonymous program in a way that a straight addict can find identification with it.
Okay, so what I'm sort of imagining, but also seeing and having heard from also in that Jack P interview that happened later, you have Jack then talking to Bill Wilson, talking to the sheriff, and he's got a member that he knows. It seems to me Jack is the guy who got Jimmy involved in this project, essentially. And Jimmy, because this is being written in 1952, and the stuff that Jimmy and them write about is in 1953. That we put the founding of NA as we know it today as having happened in 1953. I think it's a compelling question. Could one argue that Jack P., I wouldn't say the founder of NA, but certainly a member whose efforts resulted in the founding of NA. What would you say to that assertion?
Boy, do you want to?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, I think very much that Jack played a role in it, Ron, because, you know, in the 1986 interview with the Board of Trustees, he talks about starting a meeting in June of 53, and then my memory's not serving me correctly, but I think he brought Jimmy to it maybe the third one, and from that point on, Jimmy kind of took over the no-name meeting. So I think Jack had a hand in the beginning of it, very much so. You know, I can just visualize him and Jimmy and Cy sitting around, the North Hollywood clubhouse trying to figure out what to do to help these addicts. But getting back to your original question, I mean, I believe that Jack had just as much a hand in the beginning of it as Jimmy did and as Cy M did.
You might think of Jack as the Houston of the West Coast.
The only qualification I put with that is Houston went after this with intense desire. It was a little unheard of to work with addicts, and where Jack seemed to be more of being asked to do this by the sheriff's department, and then he gets out.
Yeah, that makes sense. That if I hear you right, and you were breaking up pretty badly there, but Houston was a lot more. It was his own effort and his own passion and something that he was trying to do. Jack was doing something that he was asked to do by a county sheriff and then was just sort of trying to sort out how he might do something like this.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, Houston was really inspired and stuck with it from 1947 until he died in 63.
Okay.
Jack turned it over as quickly as he could and said, I'm out, you know.
Well, I mean, that's what we've read so far. I tend to think there's more of a story there with Jack. And maybe one day we'll be able to uncover more. But,
you know, I was actually at Jimmy's memorial service when Jack got up to the microphone and told the story. Unfortunately, that was 30 years ago now. And I would not be able to tell you for sure. But I know that after he got done speaking, that Bob Stone come up to me and basically said, we need to get that guy and get that story. And he also seemed to feel like maybe Jack was placing a little more emphasis on his role than nobody had ever heard of Jack P or of anything prior to Jimmy starting it in 53. So to have Jack kind of insinuate that maybe he was doing something in 52 that got picked up in 53, it was hard to believe that at that time. So I was just absolutely tickled when I saw the letters that you guys dug up in the archives that basically corroborated Jack's version of events.
Yeah, that's what makes doing this type of stuff pretty exciting, to be honest with you, is when you find a new little nugget there that it just corroborates stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, the The name, we've touched on it a little bit, but as Dave mentioned and you mentioned, as far as we can tell, the first use of the term Narcotics Anonymous was the spinoff of from Addicts Anonymous that Danny Carlson started in New York. He called it Narcotics Anonymous, right, for reasons you've already mentioned.
Yes.
And when they started their effort in Los Angeles, they wanted to call it AANA. Is that correct? They wanted to combine it?
Yeah, in their very first meeting, they wanted to call it the San Fernando Valley AA/NA. And now here's another little mystery and a nugget. Going to the AA archives the very first time, I literally expected to find a letter in there from Jimmy requesting whether or not you can use NA or AA, or even requesting permission to use the steps. But there is none. There is no letter from Jimmy K to Bill Wilson in the archives. There is no letter from Bill Wilson to Jimmy K. So how they got in touch with the AA office, they may have called them. It's as simple as that. But they came back and I'm not sure if it was the next organizational meeting or the one after that, but they said AA had been contacted and they said, no, you can't use our name together with NA. And so it was at that meeting, and I believe that was on September the 17th, is the first time you see Narcotics Anonymous associated with the West Coast NA. And the beginning of the fellowship of NA as we know it today.
September of?
1953.
Okay. And so we know that they had the key, right? Tell us about the key.
We got diverted at this point and didn't answer that. But the key was a publication of Addicts Anonymous out of Lexington. There is evidence in the early writings of the Los Angeles Fellowship that they received the key. So this is another example of how Addicts Anonymous was the common denominator between East and West Coast NA back then.
Let me back up for a second, though. I do, you know, you just said, is that the first time we see it? There's, Ron, there's a book called A Narcotics Menace that was published in 1952. And in that book, there's a little section about wanting to start a hospital for addicts. And it says that two or three members showed up from Narcotics Anonymous. And then it also says something about Addicts Anonymous. Maybe Chris can jump in here because he's got his computer up and looking at it.
But if that's 1952, then yeah. That's at least 2 years after we know that Danny began using the name Narcotics Anonymous in New York.
That's correct, but it predates our use of it in 1953.
At this point, we begin to have more severe bandwidth issues with Chris's connection. So he hung up and began to try to get reconnected by phone.
While he's doing that, I have Narcotics Menace in my hand. Attending the meeting were two members of the Los Angeles group of Narcotics Anonymous, also known as AA Addicts Anonymous, an organization founded at the Narcotics Hospital of Lexington, Kentucky.
We broke again right there to get Chris reconnected, but what Dave had established in that reading was what Boyd had just alluded to. This was a reference in 1952 to Narcotics Anonymous in Los Angeles, which identified itself as an outgrowth of the Lexington, Kentucky Hospital and the Addicts Anonymous group there. This is a tantalizing tidbit. Did it suggest that Danny Carlson's NA out of New York had created some kind of presence in Los Angeles prior to the movement associated with Jimmy K, or could this have referred to what Jack P had gotten going in 1952 and Jimmy had gotten involved with? We may never know for sure.
So what I was saying is that the in the Narcotic Menace, they say Narcotics Anonymous, also known as Addicts Anonymous. And so they're using the terms kind of interchangeably at this point in this particular publication. But they say that, you know, the Addicts Anonymous came out of Lexington.
That's just so interesting that they're referencing a Los Angeles-based group in 1952. So it almost sounds like they got a hold of Jack I mean, it's hard to piece that one together with what we know. What's also interesting is I wonder when the West Coast group uses the name AANA, do they mean Addicts Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, or do they mean Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous?
No, they mean Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. Sorry, Boyd, didn't mean to.
No, that's okay.
I can't see you guys anymore since I'm off the computer.
Well, we can hear you now, so that's a big
yeah. Important. But no, it's I mean, it's a good speculation, Ron. But because they called AA, I tend to believe that it was Alcoholics Anonymous, or actually, it's written in the minutes that it.
Yeah, it's written. Yeah, it's written as the name San Fernando Valley Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous has been voted on and accepted. And then as you go down to September 14th, 1953, the sixth committee meeting held at 8 p.m. at 10146 Stagg Street. And it says, quote, SF Valley AANA, change to, quote, Narcotics Anonymous. The other thing that we see with Narcotics Anonymous is we see in May of 1951, a couple publications on that same date that reference chapters of NA being started in Los Angeles. And these are references that Danny C is making in the Time magazine article that was published in May of 51.
Wow.
And so it's hard to say, you know, what was actually happening. Was he just corresponding with somebody and they were saying, hey, we're going to get something going? Or did they actually hold a meeting and get a group off the ground? But we see that in 51, a couple references to that in May of 51. And then we see in 52, we see the Jack P correspondence with Bill, and we see the Narcotic Menace. So, again, that's why I kind of see we're seeing these things kind of used interchangeably in this 1952 publication. And then the thing that became real interesting to me was, last year, maybe 18 months ago, when we discovered this letter from Jimmy K's son, where in December of 53, after Narcotics Anonymous has held their organizational meetings and determined the name Narcotics Anonymous and published it that way, we start seeing, we've seen this letter, him asking his dad how the Addicts Anonymous group is going. And that's just pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really compelling little tidbit there. His son calls it Addicts Anonymous.
He asked him how the Addicts Anonymous meetings are going. And, you know, as much as anything else is when you're involved in this, you do detective work. But it's like, you know, where did Jimmy Jr. hear the term Addicts Anonymous? I mean, he had to have heard it from his dad. Somewhere around LA. So it was definitely used at that time.
Well, or he couldn't remember exactly what it was called and he called it that. I mean,
that could be, Ron. That could.
You know, there's somebody mentioned the phrase the 100th monkey phenomenon to me the other day when we were talking about this thing about Chris just mentioned it a little bit ago too, this notion that when an innovation is occurring and at a time of innovation, and people are trying to emulate this innovation, the innovation in this case being AA, and the emulation being apply this to drug addicts. This is happening in different places at the same time with loose threads connecting them. And it's a little hard at that point to try to put your hands around. Is that one thing emerging? Is that multiple things emerging? There's a common narrative which says the New York Fellowship emerged directly out of contact with Lexington, and they never adopted the traditions. And this was not any kind of big negative. This was just the reality of the timeline. The timeline being they kind of predated the traditions. Their primary energies kind of predated the traditions. And then they already had some things established and just never adopted the traditions. Whereas the West Coast had looser ties, not such direct ties to Lexington. And they had controversy about the traditions also in the form of the personality clash between Cy and Jimmy, where Cy was interested in doing things like having starting a clinics for addicts and that sort of stuff. And Jimmy was very interested in adopting the traditions. The thing lasts until 1959 in that sort of mode, and then where it briefly folds, restarts up, and this time they adopt the traditions and they never die again. Do you think that this is what's hard for me to see, is it probably true that the connection between Dan, I mean, it seems certainly true that the connection between Danny and his efforts and what went on in New York between them and Lexington was much, much stronger than the connection between Jimmy et al. And what happened in Los Angeles and the Lexington Hospital, even though there is evidence of some connection there in the form of the Key, which is a publication out of Lexington that these guys had and referenced, the purpose statement that you guys mentioned before. So there's some talk of a trip that Jimmy took to Lexington. Is there any information about that that anyone knows?
About the only thing that we've come up with, Ron, was that in an interview with Kathy, she says that she recalls her dad going. So we've never really substantiated it. We have a verbal yes that it did happen, but we've not got any paper trail for it.
I agree that, you know, there was absolutely a much more direct connection from Lexington to early New York NA. I think what's unclear is, you know, how much contact Danny maintained with Houston or Addicts Anonymous once he left Lexington. And it seems like he probably was influenced more by the Salvation Army and NACON, the other non-addicts supporters at that time. Whereas Jimmy always seems to have this rooted foundation and a strong culture of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is absent from what Danny had. The influence of Addicts Anonymous is certainly less direct on the West Coast because of the heavy influence of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. But we do see, you know, our purpose appearing in the organizational meetings, and they even talk about how in their seventh committee meeting on September 21st that Gil Dekay voted and accepted to print our purpose and to contact all the newspapers.
To me, the way I've always interpreted that is that they had the key. Yeah, they were receiving the key, and that was the link between them and Lexington. And that early correspondence that you guys dug up where Jack P. It was suggested to him by Bill that he contact Lexington. So there was probably some contact there. He probably sent something to Lexington and got, or called them or in some way contacted them. But we don't even know that for sure, right?
Right. No, we don't.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, let me just pursue that a little bit more. I think one of the really important things here is there's two narratives. One is the one I just articulated, where you have two separate movements that occurred that ended up with the same name, Narcotics Anonymous, and that the one that adopted the traditions survived. The one that never did not, and that they were not the same fellowship, and that even that there was some a little even, you know, anecdotal stuff that Jimmy had contacted Danny and had said, you know, Jimmy was interested in trying to do something together, but he wasn't. He called them something more like a social service agency than a 12-step fellowship, and he didn't really want to affiliate with them. He just basically could not see them mixing. That's one narrative. Two distinct separate fellowships never did merge. The one that started in 1953 survived. And then there is this other harder to get your head around narrative that says several things were popping at once, starting in the late 40s, early 50s, culminating in what we now know as Narcotics Anonymous, and that we should think of that whole time of things popping at once as the founding. I mean, I find it harder to accept that second narrative as some way of describing the founding of Narcotics Anonymous. Would you take issue? What would you take?
I have a different opinion on it. I mean, ever since I started doing this research, it's all come under one umbrella for me. And it was only until Facebook and I started seeing some people. It was actually a time on Facebook where somebody brought up, we were talking about Addicts Anonymous, and somebody said, well, that's all good and fine, but that's not our fellowship. That's not us. And so at that point in time, I became aware that there were definitely people that didn't think the same way I did, imagine that, and that they very much viewed, the start of NA in July of 1953. I personally have just always looked at it as really and truly, it's a movement for people that are addicted to substances besides alcohol. But there's even more of a framework that use a modified version of the AA steps. And that, in a nutshell right there, talks about Addicts Anonymous, the early New York NA with Danny C. That also talks about – it also talks about Betty Tom. I mean, because she played a significant role in this development too, even to the point of where if all she did was piss Bill Wilson off to draw a line in the sand and say, you know, we can't accept anybody in our fellowship that just – except for those that have alcohol or problems with alcohol.
She seemed to piss everybody else off too. I mean, I've heard Bob Barrett say, you know, he met her and ultimately – realized this is she. He couldn't have anything to do with her. That what she, her, and what she was up to. So, she was alienating more than just Bill because she was just so persistent with what she was pressing.
Well, and I think the in Jimmy's 20th anniversary talk about the Big Mama and Big Papa, I was I'm pretty sure it was referencing her.
Her and Baby Si.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, that's the way I've always viewed it. I've always viewed it as kind of a movement. And I also understand that people don't necessarily see it the same way as I do. And that's fine. I don't really have a problem with it.
With your second narrative, Ron, yeah. You know, my take on it a little bit is that is a lot harder to kind of measure and determine, you know. How do you assess what was the influence of the publicity that Danny C. generated? You know, you look at his obituary runs in the London Times, New York Times, a number of other papers. So it's getting, you know, this idea out there into the national consciousness about a 12-step group for addicts. And it's kind of hard to kind of measure that, but, you know, like what was the impact of that? But I think a key question is, you know, if they're in Southern California, where did they come up with the idea that, well, let's create a separate group for addicts?
Well, we kind of know that because the Jack, we have that letter from Jack. We have that he wrote to the office, and they
that's one idea. That's one idea that they get the idea because somebody in the criminal justice system suggests that they start a Narcotics Anonymous group. So then the question becomes, where did the criminal justice system get the idea that this is a good idea? Okay, or so is it?
Let's even stipulate that. Let's say, okay, that there is something out there called Narcotics Anonymous. It's gotten press. People know about it. And so that idea is on the wind, and that idea is stimulating what's going on in Los Angeles, just for the sake of discussion. Does that then make it a single organization? Or could it be still two separate entities arising from the same idea and the same common threads back to Lexington.
I agree with that completely, that separate efforts, separate but influenced by similar processes and similar ideas. But it's hard to say. I mean, the only audio that I've heard of Jimmy saying, you know, we started long before we existed in name because of the addict that was couldn't find the identification necessary in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's hard to say, you know, what was it that, you know, was that when did that idea take hold where Jimmy and others say, hey, let's do this. Let's start this meeting. Let's start this group. Let's get this effort going. We can certainly see a lot of things that are influencing it and happening at that time, but where was that 100th monkey in their process?
You know, it sounds, as we hash it out, it sounds like it's one of those many things that comes down to the both are true conclusion. You know, both of these narratives are true, that there were two separate entities that formed and there were common roots. I guess the only reason it matters is to try to put a date on the founding of your organization and the whole mythology that grows up around founders and all of the, you know, right now, you know, Jimmy Kay is, you know, almost universally accepted as the founder of NA, even though he never said he was the founder of NA. He always said it was a group effort. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. Let me weigh in here. I mean, I have some feelings on this too. The way I see it, something was going to take shape on the West Coast. There clearly was a movement, and it's just such a natural that what worked for alcoholics is going to work for those who identify as addicts because they have problems with drugs. But the way I see it, what in fact happened was somebody got heard about Narcotics Anonymous. There were too many publications out there, national publications, noting the fellowship in New York. Time Magazine, New York Times, Saturday Evening Post. For people who are interested in working in this field or who themselves have problems with addiction, not to know of it, to be aware of it. So rather than invent their own approach to it out of whole cloth, coming out of AA, they certainly heard about what was going on the East Coast, took the name, tried to at least adopt that purpose as stated in the key, and that was the origin of it. That's just the way I see it. So I can't even make a distinction. I don't look for there to be one unbroken thread of inspiration to end up with what we know as Narcotics Anonymous, but clearly the influence of the New York Fellowship was felt, in my opinion, out on the West Coast.
So would you put, just as a matter of curiosity, would you put the founding of NA as we know it today to be when Danny Carlson came out of the hospital and started his group in New York?
I would have to say he used the term Narcotics Anonymous first. So they would be the first meetings of Narcotics Anonymous.
Well, that's not the question, though. That's not the question.
Well, as we know it, I have a problem with as we know it, because I don't think, from what I can read, what occurred on the West Coast in the 50s, leading up to kind of a rebirth in the 60s, I don't know that what was going on in 53, 54, 57 and up was NA as we know it.
Okay, well,
I agree with that.
See, I would term it as when Jimmy and Sylvia and Penny started it back in 60, is that's when the beginning of NA as we know it happened.
But that's not different from AA. I mean, if you were to say AA, they don't use the term AA as we know it, you know, because AA didn't look anything like it does today, but there's no distinction. You know, before the traditions were formulated, of saying, well, that's not AA as we know it.
Right. My problem with the term as we know it is it's often used as a way to dismiss what occurred on the East Coast in 49, 50, in the early 50s. And I'm just not willing to dismiss it.
Well, I certainly don't mean to dismiss it with that phrase. And I'm perfectly willing to not use the phrase. I've noticed that for those who have what feels to me like an investment in the narrative that it's one continuous fellowship, then that phrase is something that, you know, they don't like. So let's stay away from it. Let's say the NA that exists today, was it founded in 1949-50 when Danny came out of the hospital and started what he started in New York, or was that a different fellowship, different entity?
I couldn't answer that question simply. I mean, look at the trouble we're having to try to put it into some context. I suppose if you take the name Narcotics Anonymous and look at it as having been adopted by the West Coast folks, and it started on the East Coast in New York City, then yes, the origin of the fellowship would be in New York City in 1949, certainly with massive changes by virtue of the fact that those folks came out of AA and Danny Carlson did not. Obviously it's a difficult topic, and one that I don't feel that personally I'm invested in a particular narrative on it all, but I find it fascinating. And all I ever wanted to do in my research when I got involved in it was really make sure that everybody got noted and got credit for what they did along the way. And one of the great things I think that Chris and Boyd have done is really put all of that information out there. And I think people are going to walk away and they're going to have their heroes before and after such an event. But I just love that all of this information is out there. And to me, it's just a beautiful and natural progression from, if you know, to really go back to the origin, Bill Wilson's spiritual enlightenment on a small bed at Towns Hospital in 1935, actually winter, December 34. So it's all rather remarkable.
Yeah, and maybe it's me who's invested in it. What I was addressing there is this phrase, as we know it. NA as we know it seems to be a hot button. And I don't mean it in any kind of hot button-ish kind of way. What I mean is the Narcotics Anonymous Fellowship that exists today. That's what I mean.
Yeah. And I have to say that when I talk about history in any event around here, and I certainly cover New York, and I always say that I'm alive today because a little white book published on the West Coast ended up in 1969 at the rehab that I ended up in 1974. I mean, that's the kind of reverence I have for what went on the West Coast.
Yeah, and I think it's true of most of us that have been clean for a long time, that little white book floating around and resulting in, because it contained all the meeting formats, and it contained everything that you needed to actually start a group and hold a group, and it had a phone number on it that you could call and connect you back to the source, and that was that Los Angeles movement. How would you answer that, Chris?
Yeah, so, you know, I look at them as being very, very different kind of efforts that didn't happen with, they weren't coordinated efforts. They weren't saying, hey, let's try to do this together or anything like that. But it was an interesting time when society and addicts are beginning to think maybe recovery is a possibility, and efforts, you know, everything's kind of gaining momentum and so forth.
Yeah.
I think another thing that's very interesting to me is that in 1959, you're looking at two versions of NA, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, that had very different experiences. And at the time, if you were kind of putting money on which one was going to thrive, most people probably would have laid it on New York. And I think there's some conversation there about, you know, the role, how important the traditions were. And the lessons that have been learned from fellowships that didn't have the traditions, and fellowships that strayed from the traditions, and fellowships that re-embraced and adhered to the traditions.
I could not agree more.
We talked this way for over 2 hours. This is the phenomenon that since my early recovery we've called talking program. But it was getting very late, and we knew we had to call it. And so it is with this episode of the Recovery Cast. We'll bring it to a close with more thoughts about how NA as it exists today, regardless of whom we credit for its founding and when we say it began, owes everything to what came before it. From Alcoholics Anonymous to Addicts Anonymous to Danny's New York movement and to so many other things. So we leave you with these thoughts.
If you want to talk about the birth of an idea, the birth of a vision, the birth of a possibility, and then the germination of that possibility into what eventually took form and still exists today, then that is germinated out of Lexington to New York, and that is what eventually blossoms and flowers, that idea. If you remove all kind of tribalism and importance on the organization, but put the focus on the movement, the idea, then it started in New York. It started in Lexington. It started in AA, but I mean it. Houston, Danny, and all of that is sort of the birth of this movement and this idea and this possibility. But if you want to talk about people who got together and created something, and then, you know, see that starts to introduce something a little more tribal to it. But I think a lot of people in NA today want to find that origin, that genesis. What is the genesis of what we're doing right now?
That's a beautiful way of describing that, Ron. I mean, it really is.
And, it is.
You know, in many ways, you know, just a bunch of people around the country paddling, trying to get the boat moving, you know, and some people did it in a way that, you know, was successful. Some people did it in a way that taught us things to say, hey, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to be sustainable if you paddle this way. But everyone contributed. You know, it may be a little hard to quantify and measure all that, but everyone contributed. And kind of the interesting question for me is, what would Danny C and what would Jimmy K think today if they looked and they saw how many addicts were meeting freely without police harassment under the auspices of 12-step recovery? You know, what would they think? You know, what could Danny have ever imagined or envisioned that there would be addicts worldwide using the 12 steps to find freedom from addiction? You know, could Jimmy have envisioned, you know, a day where addicts could meet so freely with such acceptance and absence of harassment?